Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. We have something very special planned for you this week. We have taken interviews that I've done with World War II veterans on my America's Veterans Story Show and reworked these so that you can hear these stories this week during Memorial Day. This is such an important week that we remember those that gave or were willing to give everything so that we can live in liberty and freedom and prosperity. I hope that you enjoy each and every one of these shows.
World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, and our other wars and conflicts. America's fighting men and women strapped on their boots and picked up their guns to fight tyranny and stand for liberty. We must never forget them. Welcome to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. These stories will touch your heart, inspire you, and give you courage. We stand on the shoulders of giants. Here's Kim Munson.
Welcome to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That is americasveteranstories.com. This show precipitated from a trip that I took in 2016 with a group with the Denver Police Activities League that accompanied students and four D-Day veterans back to Normandy for the 72nd celebration of the landing of the Allied forces to free Europe from Hitler and the Nazis. On the line with me, and this is part three of an interview with Major General John Ron Jr. And the previous show, we stopped. It was the second day after the D-Day landings. General Ron was with the 5th Ranger Battalion. General Ron, welcome to the show again.
Well, thank you, Kim.
We stopped on our last broadcast, and people can find that if they go to my website and put in your last name, R-A-A-E-N. They'll be able to have all the shows come up that we have recorded with you. We had stopped the last show at the middle of the second day after D-Day. Take it from there, General Ron.
Yeah, well, I'd like to go back a little bit because I'd like to go back to the morning of D-Day, or D plus one, actually, and talk a little bit about it. I alluded to it in our previous, but on the very morning of D-Day, D plus one, my goodness, it's my tongue, not my brain, that's mixed up. I woke up to the sound of a battle. And the battle was about 200 yards south of me, where the Germans were attacking part of the beachhead in probably company-sized force. There were a couple of light armored vehicles involved. I noticed for the first time that we had some tanks with us, and they were just sitting there doing nothing with this battle about 200 yards away. So I climbed up on the tank, banged on the rifle on the turret with my rifle butt, and finally got a sleepy lieutenant to look out at me, and I said, "Hey, young man, there's a battle about 200 yards over here. Why don't you get involved?" Well, he took a look at it through his field glasses and spoke on the radio, and the next thing I knew, we had about five tanks shooting machine guns at that particular battle, and you could see the Germans advancing, and they were able to discriminate between our forces and the German forces. I asked him, I said, "Hey, you're just using machine guns. Why don't you use your cannon?" He says, "The target is too ill-defined." Well, I left it at that, and then I was asked to go out to lead a patrol. It was a very strange patrol. It was a wartime patrol. I had the battalion sergeant major with me. I had the battalion supply sergeant with me, corporal who was a driver, and myself. And we went out in diamond formation and swept the area between the coastal road and the beach. And we got in a couple of firefights with German stragglers who, in essence, ran away. And at that time, we heard the vehicles cranking up, and the Ranger force was about to move out on Point d'Auc. Well, my two sergeants, master sergeants, deserted me, saying, hey, we got to be back with a battalion for this one. And that left me and Sharp. But I had another mission. I was to report to the 29th Division headquarters, which I did. I went in to see General Gerhardt. Of course, I had to remember who won the World Series in 1939 and little things like that to get past the MPs. But in any event, I finally got into General Gerhardt, and he knew my father quite well, so we had nice little family chats. And he finally, after my report to him, which was what our plans were, he said, well, what can I do for you? And I said, well, we're pretty short of ammunition. We can use a lot of ammunition. So he turned to his aide-de-camp and says, take Captain Ron down to the beach, find him a vehicle, and load it up with whatever ammunition he wants at the ASP, which is exactly what we did, Sharp, I, and this lieutenant. And we loaded it up with rifle, machine gun, and mortar ammunition. We got the Jeep working with the help of an engineer sergeant who happened to be on the beach. And there's a lot of work to degunking, you might say, a vehicle that had been prepared to run totally underwater. And we got all that stuff off and got the thing so it was working very nicely. Sharp climbed in with me and our ammunition, and we started up the road. It was about a mile from the beach to Vierview, maybe a little bit less. We turned right on the coastal road and started out in pursuit of the relief force for Plant Auk. And it was a pretty sporty trip. There were German stragglers all over the place shooting at us as we went down the road. But we were moving fast enough that we were a very difficult target to hit. But we finally came to a T in the road. Do we go right or left? Well, I dismounted and looked at the battle debris, and you couldn't tell. There were battle debris on each of the forks of the road. So I chose the one that went back toward the beach, and it was the right one, it turned out. And we proceeded another 4 or so miles and ran into the tail end of the relief force for Plant Auk. We distributed the ammunition, picked up the walking wounded, and suddenly the Jeep stopped. And the reason it stopped was it had run out of gas. Well, I know there was enough gas for another 200 miles in it. But one of those German stragglers' rifle shots had hit the gas tank, and it had been dripping gas the whole time. So we finally ran out after 5 miles of driving instead of 200. I located the battalion executive officer, who was the executive officer for the task force. And he had me check the tanks for their position. Were they good fighting positions? He knew that I'd been in the armored force, come from the 10th Armored Division, and that I knew a little bit about tanks. So he put me on that task. And I went around and I checked the tanks, and they were all in good hull down or hull defilade positions. I reported back to Major Sullivan, the exec, and he said, well, Red, he said, division has called the tanks back to the beachhead. They're worried about counterattacks tonight. So Colonel Metcalf has been called for, and I've been called for, and that leaves you in command. Actually, he said, the monkey is on your back.
Oh,
goodbye. And with that, he climbed on a tank, went back to the beachhead, and left me in command of a battalion-sized force deep in enemy territory. I was totally untrained for it. Didn't have the slightest idea what to do, but I called the company commanders in, and we worked up a plan of defense for the night. I also sent out two men to see if they could locate the 2nd Ranger Battalion, which was no more than 1,000 to 1,200 yards away. And with that, I went back to sleep for the first time in 4 days.
Okay. And quick question on that. First of all, how old are you at this time, General Ron? Do you remember? 22 years old. And then the other thing that you just mentioned, you went to sleep for the first time in 4 days. I just want that to sit with our listeners, to just think about what you were going through, you and the other soldiers were going through. That's pretty powerful.
Well, I thank you for that. But it was basically, I knew that I really didn't have a job until we set up a headquarters. And there was no way we were going to set up a headquarters on D-Day the way things were operating, although we did set up one D-Day night. But we dismantled it for the D+1, and I really had no job. That was why I was sent on that patrol down to the beach to see General Gerhardt, picked up the ammunition, things like that. I went on several patrols or individual reconnaissances, some of which were really quite scary, just to be walking down the ditch of a road deep in enemy territory. You know there's no American troops ahead of you, and it was sporty, but that was what my job was, which was do whatever had to be done on the spur of the moment. So the previous two nights, I had stayed up all night without sleep. And the reason why, I was just letting the company commanders get their sleep instead of standing watch. I stood three straight watches on the morning of D-Day, starting at midnight, and was on watch until 4:30 when they dropped anchor and we loaded into the boats and so on. So I had gotten no sleep at all. And here we were in Saint-Pierre-du-Mont, and I just went up in a hayloft and fell asleep. And I don't remember whether I woke up or was awakened, but I went down to find out if my two patrol soldiers had gotten back. And they had. And so I went over and I asked Sergeant Moody, I said, did you find Colonel Rutter? He said, yes, sir, he's on the line. And he handed me a telephone. And I got to talk with Colonel Rutter, who was in command of the Ranger force that landed at Pointe d'Auc. It seems as though my two patrolmen, when they came back from the Ranger headquarters on Pointe d'Auc, had found a reel of wire and had laid wire through the German lines during a German counterattack, and brought us the lines necessary to have telephone contact with Colonel Rutter. Which was very useful, because almost at that exact time, I was still on the phone with Rutter, the battalion came up, and Lieutenant Colonel Schneider, my battalion commander, jumped out of his jeep and said, have you found Rutter yet? And I said, yes, sir, he's on the line. So Schneider got to talk with Rutter, and they laid the plans for our attack, which were essentially the plans I had made the night before. And we implemented them, moved out around 6:30 or 7. By 9 o'clock, we had the point completely relieved and secure. There was still a lot of fighting around our western edge, but the main part of the point, we had secured it quite well. And I was sitting on an emplacement, a big concrete gun position, and chatting with a couple of second ranger officers whom I knew, when suddenly out of the south, out of the brushwork, burst a bunch of tanks firing their machine guns and their cannon right straight at us. Well, a young lieutenant motor officer from the 2nd Battalion, I saw him drive up. Where he got the jeep, I don't know. It was probably Colonel Schneider's jeep, my battalion commander, but he drove up to the tank, crashed into it, jumped on the turret, banged on the turret with his submachine gun, got the turret commander to speak with him. He said, look, you're firing on our troops. And at that point, of course, by radio, all fire ceased. We had 8 men killed or wounded. 2 of them were killed. 6 were wounded in that particular blue-on-blue situation.
General Rons, that was our tanks that was firing on our guys. Is that right?
That's our tanks firing on our guys.
It was very courageous of that guy from the 2nd Battalion to actually get that stop then, yes?
Yes, it was very courageous. And it wasn't until a little more than a month ago, I didn't remember his name. I just knew he was the motor officer of the 2nd Battalion. But it seems as though when he died, his obit was published. And I looked at it, and Eddington? Wow. I said, that's the name. That's the name of the motor officer. And sure enough, he is the guy who had gone and climbed on that tank.
Okay. General Ron, I just got chills as you said his name. Let's go to break, and we'll continue with the story. This is Kim Munson with America's Veteran Stories. I'm talking with General John Ron, who was with the 5th Ranger Battalion. We're going through his experiences at D-Day, D plus 1, D plus 2. That is D-Day plus the next day. Before we do that, though, one of my great partners is Hooters Restaurants. They have 5 locations here in the metro area: Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, and Colorado Springs. They have all kinds of specials for game day specials, to-go specials, and dine-in. They also have great dine-in specials as well. So be sure and check out HootersColorado.com. These stories are so important that we hear them, understand them. And one of the reasons that we can do this is because of my great partners. And one of those great partners is Karen Levine. You know her. She's an award-winning realtor with RE/MAX Alliance. And we're in the spring selling season. And now is a time for people to reach out to you, Karen, because you really are helping people navigate this crazy market to buy or sell their home. So thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Kim. And yes, the spring season is upon us, and lots of people are thinking about selling and buying housing. And I'm here to help them get settled in before the new school year starts in August.
Which is right around the corner as fast as time's going. I can't believe it.
Definitely.
And this series that we're doing with these Vietnam veterans is so important, Karen, because it's been 50 years. We are in these guys. The title of the book is Echoes of Our War, Vietnam Veterans Reflect 50 Years Later. And you and I were talking as kind of preparing for this interview that, I mean, we were both kids and kind of remember the Vietnam veterans coming home. And, you know, we were living charmed lives. We didn't realize what was happening with these guys over in Vietnam.
Most definitely, Kim. I just, you know, you do the math, and I was probably in 5th, 6th, 7th grade, and life was very protected. We lived in middle America suburbia, and I didn't understand the Vietnam War. And I know when our veterans returned from serving and protecting America that they weren't received very graciously.
That is an understatement.
As a children's perspective.
Yes, they were not. And it is time that we certainly recognize that. And certainly it's a long time later. But that's why this series is so important. And Karen Levine, I so appreciate your partnership on this.
Well, and I think it's just important for our young people today to understand the sacrifices that were made for the freedoms that they have in their day-to-day living.
Most definitely. And Karen Levine, thank you so much. We're going to go to break. We'll be right back with Major General John Ron.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
Welcome back to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That is americasveteranstories.com. On the line with me is Major General John C. Ron, Jr. He was with the 5th Ranger Battalion on D-Day. We're going through his experiences of D-plus-1, D-plus-2. And we had just talked about when you had gotten to Pointe du Hoc, and we'd actually had our guys, our tanks, firing on us. Take it from there, General Ron.
Okay. As I said, a young motor officer from the 2nd Battalion took a Jeep. It must have been from my battalion because the battalion commander of the 5th came up in a Jeep. So that's the only Jeep that could be there. Anyway, he crashed it into the one of the tanks that was firing, jumped up on the tank, and with his submachine gun, persuaded the tank commander to cease and desist the firing, which happened very quickly as a result, thank goodness, of radios. And after that time, essentially what we did was reorganize the forces, and I joined Major Sullivan and three companies actually of the 5th Ranger Battalion, and proceeded from Pointe du Hoc down the main coastal road into the town of Grand Cours-les-Bains. There I was given the orders to clear the houses of right and left on the main drag there, and I proceeded to take four teams. I led one. Each team had four people in it, and we'd go to each house and go in through the front door. If it were unlocked, if it were locked, we'd bang on the door. If they didn't answer, we'd shoot the door open. And the team of four moved into the building just exactly like you see in the Ranger training pictures or the Marine training pictures and things like that. First man through looks to his left, goes to his right, second man through, goes to the left, third man through, starts up the stairs, and that type of thing. And we each of us cleared perhaps 10 houses, leapfrogging the other team on our side of the street. They were doing the same thing on the other side of the street. Well, we finally cleared all the houses and really found no Germans. We found many frightened French people down in the basement, but we didn't find anything that was very threatening. After that, we proceeded across country to a place called Mazy. And at Mazy, the Germans had a tremendous, it was about 10 by 5 miles in it. This fortification had three artillery batteries. I've been told four hospitals. I can hardly believe it. And major signal headquarters and things like that. We captured the German payroll for the Normandy area. And that was a lot of fun for some people, lighting cigarettes with French 100-franc bills and things like that. We proceeded from Mazy on to a town called Osmondville, and it was there we stopped for the night. And essentially, our combat in Normandy ended. We still, for the next week or so, sent out patrols wherever the French told us there were still German stragglers. Most of them were just trying to find a way to surrender, so we didn't take very many casualties that way. We did have German airplanes bomb us at night when we were in Osmondville and several other places, but we didn't take very many casualties there. One of my good friends was wounded there, and until he died here in Orlando fairly recently, he still had the same bleeding wound that he got there in Osmondville from Dead Check Charlie as he bombed the place. But that was essentially the end of the D-Day operation.
Okay. And how many days are we into this then, General Ron?
Well, it was D plus, let's see, one, two, three. We attacked the Maisie Battery on D plus four.
Okay.
So this is the 5th through the 6th through the 7th, 8th, 9th, and so on.
Okay. Okay. You said this is essentially the end of D-Day. What happens after this with you, General Ron?
Well, we had to do what everybody else had to do who had the opportunity to. We had to get replacements, and we were given permission to go into the combat units and find soldiers that wanted to be Rangers. We also went to the replacement depots and pulled out the brightest, sharpest young infantrymen we could find and made them into Rangers. But, of course, that means we spend a lot of time training. Meantime, we were also a part of a reaction force. The Germans were still occupying the Channel Islands, and there was with about 40,000 troops, and there was great fear that they might make a landing on the west coast of Normandy and wreak havoc with our forces that were attacking Cherbourg at that time. So we were a quick reaction force as well as being in training and performing other military duties that were required of us, which is, of course, it's get the vehicles back into shape, get the weapons back into shape, and all the time training men. One of the ways we trained the men was very interesting. The company commanders would go up to where the infantry were fighting and go to a company commander and say, hey, how would you like us to take over your position for tonight? And they all were delighted. They get a good night's sleep that way, and a Ranger company would move into the area, go out and attack the Germans all night. So then we'd pull back. The infantry would well rested by now because they'd had a good night's sleep. They'd be able to take over their job a little better, and our men would have gotten some real live fire training.
So, talk about training on the job, General Ron. That would be the definition of it. My gosh. Okay.
Yeah, well, it was a way that our company commanders developed by themselves. They just said, we've got to get these guys up to snuff fast. And the way you do it is you put them in combat and then correct their mistakes.
Wow. Okay, what happens after that, General Ron?
Well, I'll tell you a little story. We were sitting there in this place doing these three or four jobs all at once. And Dinah Shore, my favorite canary, was coming to sing for the battalion. And I was really excited about it. And just before going to the show, the battalion commander called me in and said, hey, Red, I want you to do so-and-so and so-and-so, which was actually be the advance party for the Ranger Battalion, drive through St. Lo, through the breakthrough at St. Lo, through the gap there, proceed on south, turn right into Brittany, and find the 8th Corps headquarters. That was my mission. And I said, but Dinah Shore, he said, forget Dinah Shore. You will be on the road in 5 minutes. And so I was on the road in 5 minutes and missed the whole show. But Dinah heard that we were moving out. And she came and came to the battalion and sat on a Jeep in A Company and serenaded the battalion while sitting on the hood of the company commander's Jeep. Well, that was quite a coup that was made there. Anyway, I proceeded on to Brittany, and I was not a mile behind the lead tanks, and all sorts of battle debris, frightened Frenchmen, casualties. It was very interesting following. The cartridge cases that I'd pick up to check to see if they were American were still hot, some cases. Wow. And I still hadn't found the 8th Corps. I was looking for a place called Carrefour, and I was driving down a road and saw an old French farmer in the field. He was a man with a hoe, and he was hoeing away. And he was about 100 yards in from the hedgerow from the road. I stopped the driver, and I got out very carefully, proceeded through the hedgerow across the field until I was about 20 feet from the farmer, and I said, Monsieur, Monsieur, s'il vous plaît, où est le village de Carrefour? Well, the French was good enough. The man understood, you could tell. He stopped hoeing and leaned on his hoe, and then in perfect Oxfordian English said, young man, as you obviously do not know, the word Carrefour in French means crossroads. There is no town of Carrefour. He said, you will find a very famous Carrefour approximately 2 miles ahead of you, and I think that's where you want to go. And with that, he became the man with the hoe again and started hoeing. And what I'd done was I'd run into one of these brave men who dropped by parachute long before the invasion and organized the underground and things like that. Well, it was quite interesting to have met him. And true enough, there was 8th Corps headquarters at the next big crossroads, the Carrefour. Well, they gave me my orders.
Okay, just a quick question. Just a quick question, General Ron. What possessed you to get out of the Jeep and go over and talk to the man that was in the field hoeing the crop?
I felt I was lost.
Aha. Okay.
My maps didn't show any place called Carrefour, and I knew I was headed in the right direction, but I thought that I would see if I could get some local advice, so I just went up to him, and he turned out to be a Jedburgh.
So you are one of the first guys that actually stopped and asked for directions. Ha!
Well, my father taught me never to ask for directions, because when we were going into Boston for the first time, he asked somebody for directions, and they said, well, you go down to the car barn, you turn right, and what the heck's a car barn? That type thing. So I knew never to ask directions, because you never got it right.
Well, this time you
but
did.
Here I was lost, and I didn't like to be shot at.
There you go. Okay, continue on, General Ron.
Well, they sent us to a place called Les Nevins in the Brittany Peninsula. It's a suburb of Brest, and I moved in there, laid out a bivouac area for the battalion, and true enough, 2 or 3 days later, they showed up, and we started the battle for Brittany there. And the way it started originally was we would lend a ranger company to a division, and the ranger company would maintain contact with the adjacent division, meaning that the divisions didn't have to worry about their flanks. It was a very, very wise way to do it. And we didn't take too many casualties there, though the fighting was usually rather tough because here was a silly little Ranger company of probably about 50 men by this time and doing the job of what you usually would have a whole reconnaissance squadron doing. So it was fun, and we frittered away three companies that way. When we got attached to the 29th Division, the rest of the battalion, three more companies, and became the Fort Busters to extend the lines of the 29th to the water and to capture any forts that got in our way, which we proceeded to do.
Okay, General Ron, let's stop right there. I think that'll be a great segue to go into the next segment to talk about Fort Busters. This is Kim Munson with America's Veteran Stories. I am talking with Major General John Ron about his experiences during World War II. We'll be right back. On the line with me is one of my valued sponsors, and that is Lauren Levy. He's a mortgage specialist with Polygon Financial Group. He works with a number of different lenders, which is great for you, the client. And Lauren Levy, welcome. Tell us, why are you a partner of America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson?
Well, hey, Kim, great to be back on with you. You know, when I had an opportunity to become a partner of yours on this project, I thought it was just a perfect fit. Anytime you can do things that try to help the people that have served our country, whether in action or not, they have made sacrifices and to help defend our country, and I just thought it was a great chance to try to give back a little bit and see if I couldn't help those folks out.
And there is great opportunity for veterans and military personnel right now in the mortgage arena. You and I were chatting before we did the call that there's something very special, I think, for veterans.
Yeah, and, you know, the VA loan, which is available for all veterans or active duty folks, has always been a good program. And it's always had good rates and allowed for no mortgage insurance for people that borrow or don't have a big down payment. It also allows veterans to pay cash out of their home up to higher levels than regular loans. And on top of that, it's always had great rates. Well, now, through the pandemic and just with some different specials and things, lenders have really low rates on these VA loans. We're talking things in the lower 2.375, where these veterans can really lower their payments and take advantage of these great rates.
Well, that's something that would be a great idea. People can reach you, Lauren Levy, at 303-880-8881, 303-880-8881. You and I always say, when opportunity knocks at the door, you should open it. And this is a great opportunity for veterans right now, Lauren Levy.
I agree 100%. If you have a rate anywhere over 2.875 or above, I think it's a good time to be looking at doing even just a VA streamline. They're easy to do. They don't take very long, and it can really save these veterans some important money right now.
And again, call Lauren Levy at 303-880-8881, 303-880-8881. Lauren Levy, thank you so much for your partnership.
And before we go to break, on the line with me is Hal Van Herke. He is an entrepreneur. He and his wife, Linnea, own Castlegate Knife and Tool, which is located right here in Sedalia, Colorado. And Hal is a sponsor of both of our shows, The Kim Munson Show and America's Veteran Stories. And I so appreciate that. Hal, I know that you have really enjoyed these shows that we've done this week with these World War II veterans. And, of course, the interview we're doing today with Don Whipple at the Battle of Iwo Jima. And you're a veteran, Hal Van Herke. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. And I do enjoy this program. I'm old enough that my father served in World War II. My uncles all served in World War II. And so they served all over the globe. So a lot of these stories are really close to home.
Well, and you are a veteran, and Castlegate Knife and Tool, you actually offer a discount all day, every day for our veterans and military and first responders. And I know that that's just really important to you, Hal.
Yeah, we believe that our veterans, our first responders are a unique and special type of person that have protected this country and served this country, in some cases, for generations. And we want to thank them for that contribution and that sacrifice. So we give a 10% discount all day, every day to any veteran any active duty service member or active duty or active first responder. If you come into the store in Sedalia, show us your ID and you'll get a 10% discount off of anything in the store. If you want to take advantage of that on the website, just contact us via email or phone or through social media, and we'll give you a one-time use code that you can purchase anything on the website and get 10% off. It's just our way of recognizing not only your contribution, but the fact that our warriors are a key part of our society and make society work. And we value them, not only their contribution, but the type of people they are and who they are as a person.
Well, thank you, Hal Van Herky. And that website is castlegate.com, castlegate.com. Hal Van Herky, thank you for your sponsorship, and we will talk to you next week.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Americans Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Sunday afternoons at 3 here on KLZ 560 AM and KLZ 100.7.
Welcome back to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. And be sure and check out our website. That is americasveteranstories.com. On the line with me is Major General John Ron. He landed on Omaha Beach first day of D-Day. And we're going through his experiences through D-Day. We are now to the point where the 5th Ranger Battalion starts to gain the name of Fort Busters. General Ron, let's take it from there. You are at the Battle of Brittany right now.
Right. I thank you. When we joined the 29th Division, we were on their extreme right flank, and that meant that our right flank was essentially on the water. We had to fight our way down to the water, but we managed to chase all the German units, which were poorly organized and not very effective, but we got them out of the way, and now we had our flank firmly on the water, and as a result, we could not be enveloped at that particular around that particular flank. And as we closed in on the encirclement of Brest, we ran into a fort called Tolbruch. And it was a very large fort, but fortunately, most of its artillery was oriented toward the water because the when the French had originally built it back in the 1800s, the only threat to that area was from the water. So we attacked Tolbruch. The first day we got beaten back. The second day we got air support. And the fourth flight that came in actually hit the target. The others had missed pretty badly. And when they hit the target, the assaulting platoon moved in so quickly that the Germans hadn't even shaken the dust off their helmets and were still cringing in their foxholes. So we captured that fort fairly easily that particular time. And our little company of some 50 to 60 Rangers had captured a German fort with 250 soldiers, sailors, Marines, you name it. They used everybody in the forts. Hence, they were not particularly organized, but they were very fierce fighters. But the bombing had subdued them. From that time on, we went to another fort. Les Petits, something or other, I might think of it. And during this particular fight, we had to commit our battalion reserve. And having no battalion reserve, they changed headquarters, my company, into a rifle company. We had a couple of machine guns, and all the rest were riflemen. Organized them into two platoons and put them in battalion reserve. And as we were attacking this particular fort, we had to commit the reserve. So there's my company alongside of Company F, which had been the reserve, and we started to attack the fort. Just as we reached the line of departure, I was told, "Captain, you're wanted back at headquarters." I said, "I can't go to headquarters. We're leading an attack here." The colonel said, "Get back to headquarters." So I did not participate. And the only time headquarters company actually made an infantry attack on a fortified position, which was carried pretty easily, I might add. When I got back to the headquarters, I found out the reason I was there was that the colonel wanted to go see the battle up close, and he wanted me to command the headquarters, which meant I was really commanding the battalion because he was out of radio contact almost immediately. And it was I that fought the battle. It was very interesting. Again, I was neither trained nor prepared for it, but did a pretty good job, I must say.
General Ron, a question there. Clearly, people are recognizing some kind of talent in you.
Well, no. I was usually the spare officer who didn't have any real duties to perform at the moment. And so I got stuck into all the extra jobs that showed up.
Interesting. Continue on then. So you are commanding this battle then? You're the commander for this battle.
And as I said, it was fairly easy with F Company and Headquarters Company in line. They just moved forward. The Germans put up a little bit of fight, and they were in a fortified position, but the two Ranger companies were able to overwhelm them quite easily. And at that point, we moved back. Headquarters Company was now the reserve, and we had three fighting companies to go on to the next fort, and that was a Fort de Montchamp, I think was the name of it. And from there, we went on to the next fort, and we ended up, as I think it was, we took six of these forts, and some of them were very hard battles, and some of them were relatively easy. There was a terrible ammunition shortage, artillery ammunition shortage, and rifle ammunition shortage in the early days at Brest, because the armor had moved so fast down the peninsula, and the troops, the infantry troops who were following them, had moved so fast that they'd run out of their supply lines. The supply lines just could not keep up. So batteries of artillery were limited to like 20 rounds a day, and the artillery commanders were very careful who they supported now, because knowing they only had 20 rounds, and they just had to be very chary of the targets. So we were out of artillery ammunition. We were out of rifle ammunition, and at night, for about 3 days, headquarters company entirely, every man in it, was pulling bullets out of machine gun belts and loading them into rifle clips. And we had to be so chary of the rifle clips that when a ranger had his clip ejected from the rifle, he had to get up and go out and recover that clip, because the only way he could get a loaded clip was to turn in an empty clip. It was sort of like rationing. But that's the way we had to fight there until the supply lines were restored, and they were toward the end of the Battle of Brest. I mentioned that I talked with General Romke on the radio in one of my times as battalion commander. Really, I was not the battalion commander, but I was doing the duties of the battalion commander. The radio popped off, and I was called over to it, and it was General Ramke on the radio, and he spoke to me in rather perfect English.
And describe to our listeners who General Ramke was exactly.
Well, General Ramke was the parachute commander of a division of parachutists, and was the senior commander in the defense of the city of Brest. So I was talking to the biggest guy the Germans had on their side.
Wow.
And what he wanted was to have a truce at noon the following day so that both sides could go out and recover their dead and their wounded, if there were any wounded out there. I said, well, that's way out of my pay grade, General. I'll have to talk to my seniors. I called the 29th Division. They said, absolutely not. We plan a major attack at that exact moment. So I called von Ramke back, and I told him that there was no way that we could accommodate a truce at that particular time. It would just take too long to organize it, and the truce period would be passed before our troops could actually implement the thing. And von Ramke said thank you, and that was it.
Goodness. Well, what happens after that then?
Well, we finally tightened the noose around the Germans so much that they surrendered pretty late in September. I think it was the 22nd, but I'm not sure. And at that point, we processed the prisoners and pulled back, reorganized a small amount, and again, hey, Red, your advance party officer, proceed to Bastogne, or actually he said proceed to the 8th Corps headquarters and get your orders there. So I had to drive 500 miles through France along the edge of the battlefield. In fact, I got in front of front lines a couple of times. It was very, very sporty. I remember one little time was quite interesting. I was driving along. I could hear the sounds of the battle on the far side of the town I was in. The town was kind of knocked to shreds. And as we were driving along the road, dodging debris, I noticed a soldier in a doorway. So I said to my driver, hey, Eckert, stop. Back up. And we backed up. I got out of the Jeep, went over and talked to the soldier. And I said, soldier, what's up in front of me? And he said, enemy. And I said, enemy? He said, yep. I said, well, why didn't you stop me? He said, you look like you knowed what you was doing. So, needless to say, we backed up and pulled out and found another way to get around that particular town. But that things like that made it very sporty. And it didn't happen just once. That's just the sharpest one. I just love that. You looked like you knowed what you was doing.
Oh, my goodness. General Ron, we have just about 3 minutes left of this show. You're headed to Bastogne. This is September, and Bastogne was, you know, one of the places in Battle of the Bulge where we really, it was really tough for us. What would you say over the next couple of minutes as we would prepare for a next show to talk about the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, I didn't last the Battle of the Bulge. I was knocked out. It started on the 16th, and I was a casualty on the 22nd. And although there was increased enemy activity, I will say that, and it was very heavy increase in enemy activity, we were pretty far south of where the German penetrations were, like at Bastogne and Wiltz and places like that. So although I was in what was called the Battle of the Bulge, I really wasn't in it, though we had much heavier fighting as a result of the Bulge. The German forces that weren't in the actual penetration were all attacking to keep the troops, our troops, occupied. Jeez. So we wouldn't pull out and reinforce the people defending against the Bulge penetration.
Okay. General John Rahn, we have a minute left on this particular show. What is the kind of the final thought you want to leave with our listeners today?
Well, if you're soldiers, it's training. Training makes you able to respond to things you didn't expect. And training is the key to victory. That really is the message to the soldiers. And to those who are not soldiers, I'd say patriotism comes pretty close, because patriotism leads to support, and support leads to good performance. Believe me, the World War II support we got from the people was just unbelievable. And couldn't have asked for more than the nation gave us.
General John C. Rahn, Jr., this has been such an honor to go through this experience that you had with going on shore in Normandy at D-Day and then to get to Battle of the Bulge. Thank you so much for this interview. I greatly appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome, Kim.
Okay. And my friends, this is Kim Munson with America's Veteran Stories signing off. God bless you and God bless America.
Thank you for listening to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson.